There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
No business like it, everything about it is appealing.
Why, it's grand.
And everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling.
You're a smash.
When you are stealing.
That final. Oh, that extra bow, yeah. That's Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters, as if you didn't know, with their very, I don't know, pumpy take on that Irving Berlin classic, There's No Business Like Show Business. The song I reckon I wish I'd written. I mean, what a line. There is no business like show business, like no business I know. If I could write that line, I'd be happy, but Irving Berlin's already done it. Anyway, we're talking today about a particular sector of show business, what are we going to call them? The second theatre companies in Australia's big cities, the ones that aren't the MTC or the STC, the ones like the Malthouse in Melbourne, Belvoir in Sydney, La Boite in Brisbane. What do we want from these companies? What should they focus on? Are they there to put on the great plays or foster new talent? Are they cradles of the avant-garde? Are they there to challenge the flagship companies to upset the people that are in the big theatres? What are they there for? Van Badham is a theatre maker and she's the Guardian Australia's theatre critic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Cathcart.
Nice to have you here. And Sam Strong is also with us. He's the Associate Artistic Director at the Melbourne Theatre Company. After working at such second theatres, the Griffin Theatre, Belvoir, Red Stitch Actors Theatre. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sam, we shouldn't call them a second theatre. What are we going to call them?
I mean, it is difficult because there's not necessarily an industry phrase for them. And I think companies like Belvoir and the Malthouse are, at least in terms of the industry, they're called their major performing arts companies. So it is very difficult to find a phrase for them. And I don't think they would necessarily think of themselves as collective entities. I think they're probably... they define themselves more against the other companies in their individual cities, I think.
Yeah, now that's an interesting issue. The other theatres, maybe, Van.
Yes, I like the other theatres. I like the notion that we have a main stage performing arts house in the city of Melbourne. That would be MTC. In Sydney, there's the STC. And then there's the other place, Belvoir in Sydney, Malthouse in Melbourne. And it's a place that challenges the orthodoxy or the mainstream values of the first big house.
So it's a challenge.
Personally, I think so. Artistic tension makes cities interesting. I think the idea of there being two major performing arts companies in a big city that are in conversation with one another about what theatre and what performance is really vital to a diverse and engaged artistic conversation for the entire city.
Now, the trigger for this conversation really is the fact that the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne is going through some soul searching at the moment. It's looking for a new artistic director at a time when its attendances and its box offices are lower than you would hope. They've fallen a bit. So I guess that was the reason why I thought we should discuss this. What would you like to see? If you had an open go at setting up a new theatre company, let's say Malthouse has said, okay, what are we going to do with this company? All ideas on the table. What could you do with that kind of company? Let's go with you, Van.
Well, I'm a former employee of the Malthouse Theatre. I was there for a couple of years as an artistic associate, and I love the role of the Malthouse as an avant-garde space. Certainly when I was at the Malthouse a couple of years ago, very much the artistic mission was about producing the shows that weren't on at the MTC and having a very clear role as a place that pushed form. And that's really important in the theatre and really important in theatrical practice, that it becomes very easy to revisit the well-made play and go back to the canon and do shows from plays from 50 years ago, from 100 years ago, from 500 years ago. That's very easy to do in the theatre. But art, to be art, has constantly got to reinvent and evolve. And the role of a company like Malthouse is to push that envelope and to make that bold avant-garde statement going, well, what are we doing as theatre
practitioners? But isn't that what they've been doing? That's the mission. I mean, they rebranded themselves. They were Playbox and they came out of Playbox Theatre, and Playbox Theatre's mission was to encourage new Australian writing. And when Michael Cantor moved in there, and whenever it was, 2004, they really just pushed that to one side and said, oh, no, it's going to be more avant-garde.
Well, it's a long conversation,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think for me to go back a step. I think sometimes the idea of pushing form or being at an artistic avant-garde or being an artistic avant-garde rather can mean more to the industry than it does to the audience. And I think in some ways any theatre company, notwithstanding its size, is attempting to make great art. And so sometimes those divisions between what's main stage and what's not can actually cloud the simplicity of that mission, which
But with respect, don't we want that group of theatres, these second, let's call them the other theatres, yeah. The other theatres, we do want them to attend to what audience is prepared to go and see, aren't we? I mean, once we're making a financial investment in them and we're paying money to people to run the thing, if they're just going to make a loss and no one wants to come...
I think they're absolutely commercial entities, and all of those theatres are the size of Le Boite and Belvoir and Malthouse and should be putting on work for large audiences. I think another factor is that they might have other parts of their mission that are not as looked to by mainstage companies, and that might be in terms of artist development and the developing or the nurturing of new artists. There's a very important qualification to that, which I think the landscape has changed a bit, but that's probably a matter for later.
No, well, we can come to that, but let's just come back to the audience thing, because you pulled a funny face when I said, surely we want to make work that audiences want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's a very, like I said, it's a long conversation. I mean, the notion of an avant-garde is that you'll be ahead of everybody, and it takes time for audiences and communities to catch up with practice. And it takes decades of investing in a space as a place where new ideas and new forms will be tried out. The thing about making new art is that you can't get a reliable outcome. You have to experiment. And new art is about sometimes really spectacular failures, and sometimes it's about things that don't quite come off. Every great theatre epoch, like to produce one Brecht, you've got to produce 50 people who aren't as good as Brecht who are in the same city at the same time. To produce Shakespeare, you've got to have Robert Greene, who, you know, was his contemporary and rival who wasn't as good. That's what
Kill
it means.
Marlowe,
yeah, yeah, and Kill Off Marlowe. And that's what it means to be ahead. And investing, like Malthouse only went through that rebranding in the cultural memory not that long ago, from being a place of Australian new writing to an experimental and avant-garde house. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of investment in audience development and essentially sharing a language of experimental practice to the broader community, and expecting there can be an immediate commercial return on that is unrealistic. It takes a lot of investment, because the thing is about an avant-garde house as well is that it has an educational mission. Like Sam is entirely right. One of the most important things Malthouse does is it brings new artists, young artists, emerging practitioners, experimental practitioners, practitioners who are crossing forms from music, from opera, from dance, from different kinds of discipline into that building and into a theatrical conversation. And having a place where that kind of, you know, artistic education, artistic conversation happens.
You know,
is important.
I'm less confident than you are that good work is work that audiences don't get, and you need to educate audiences. I'm starting to think more and more artists have to listen to audiences. We've spent most of the 20th century as artists, the leading artists, saying the public don't get it, but we, the elite artists, do, and they're just going to have to come on board. And as artists have said that, art has diverged more and more and more from being a popular form. And theatre at its most vigorous, when you look through history, theatre is at its most vigorous and most exciting when it's the theatre and art form of the people, when everyone, you know, every Tom, Sue and Jane comes along and pays to go to the theatre.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you look at playwrights like Harold Pinter and Ionesco, who are two of the great playwrights of the 20th century, absolute revered as classic authors now. At the time that their shows premiered in Britain and in France, they were ignored. Empty rooms, no one turned up, appalling criticism. Shakespeare was not the most popular playwright of his day. That did go to Robert Greene. And again, we see artists of greatness and innovation who are perhaps ignored or misunderstood at their onset.
Yeah, but Shakespeare wasn't ignored in his day. I mean, Shakespeare had his own purpose-built theatre. He was doing all right.
True, but Ionesco, Pinter and a lot of the others completely ignored.
I think it's sometimes about the question is about the degree of experimentation as well, and I think sometimes when the second companies have become too preoccupied with defining themselves in relationship to the other companies or the state companies, yeah, if you like, then that can set up quite a kind of unhealthy dichotomy for both parties. So the mainstream side of that, and of course I'm slightly biased because I now work for a main stage
for the MTC.
We love you, Sam.
I make work for that and very happily make work for that audience. But I think one of the shifts that has taken place in the kind of Australian theatrical landscape in the last 5 to 10 years is there has been a dissolving of those boundaries, aesthetic, industrial, otherwise, between the mainstream and the non-mainstream. And so, you know, historically, some of these main stage companies were seen as the kind of aesthetic devil. They were making these kind of, you know, box set, well-made plays that no one liked, which actually wasn't necessarily the case.
Well,
the
only people who wanted to see them, the line went, were cashed up, aging people who had the money to become subscribers. And so they were inherently conservative in the sort of work they do. That was the line.
And I think that has fundamentally changed. I think I think main stage audiences are much more used to abstract aesthetics than they used to be. They're much more used to bolder directorial treatments. And I think partly one of the reasons that that's come about is through artists graduating through these other spaces, because that is part of their industry function, is they tend to be giving the younger practitioners, the emerging practitioners, their first mainstream opportunity. I think that's a very important role that they play.
This is Books and Arts on RN, and we're looking at the second theatres around Australia. What's their role? What do they do? What works in a second theatre? The theatres that challenge the STCs and the Black Swans and so on. Van Badham is with me, and Sam Strong. They're both theatre makers who've had experience across the industry. Let's look at Belvoir, because Belvoir is a model that seems to work. Everyone seems to agree that it's a vigorous place. What does Belvoir do? How would you characterise its remit?
Sam used to work at Belvoir. You go second. Well, Belvoir, it has a slightly different mission to Malthouse. It's very much a place that has encouraged directors and independent directors and given a space. Two of the directors who are on staff there at the moment, Annie Lou Sarks and Adina Jacobs, are interestingly graduates of the women directors placement that goes through Malthouse. So Belvoir is certainly a place that encourages a dialogue between main stage practice and more experimental and more, you know, innovative directorial experiments. The thing that Belvoir has done, and this is relevant when it comes to Malthouse, is that Belvoir has been sort of straddling that area for a very long time. When I was a school child in Sydney, when I was 10, I think I went to see my first Belvoir show, and that's a while ago now. And this is what I mean about audience development. Belvoir now has one of the most solid subscriber bases, probably the most reliable subscriber base of any theatre in the country. And they know their audience because they've encouraged and developed that audience, so their audience understands what they do and where they fit in to the ecology of theatrical practice. And that certainly means that Belvoir have been able to establish like a brand reputation for the kind of work that they do. Edgy, experimental, playing around with the canon. You get shows like The Wild Duck, which was, you know, this radical take on Ibsen that massively popular, has toured the world, and other kind of productions that they've done there. But they've been able to do that through decades of explaining what they do and creating a conversation with their community about their work.
Sam? And I think for me, one very important thing about Belvoir is that the nature of its aesthetic, and I worked there when Neil Armfield was there, comes from the space. And that's one of the unique things about these other theatres, is that they have spaces of a size that larger companies don't have.
So what's the optimal theatre size in the big cities for these sort of theatres?
Well, I have
my individual
directorial view on that. Well, actually, Belvoir Upstairs is a really fascinating model. So if you look at Belvoir Upstairs, it's about 350 seats.
Right.
And I think, you know, historically, that the work that went on there was based on that space. So Neil's body of work and the work
Neil Armfield.
Neil Armfield's body of work and what flowed after that, and it changed, of course. But, you know, that was based on work that was kind of lo-fi, it was transformative, it was actor-driven. So it was an aesthetic that very much came out of the demands, and you might say the kind of poor, at the time, the poor theatrical demands of the space. And it's true also of the downstairs theatre in Belvoir, which is currently 80 seats.
Right.
So running a theatre that is that small enables them to take risks that companies that have larger spaces aren't able to take.
There is an optimal size, though, isn't there? Because if you get too small, then you're not going to take enough money at the box office to pay your actors and your front of house. You're going to have to go to a more voluntary model of making theatre. So
I think that's absolutely the case. I don't know the literal numbers off the top of my head, but having worked at Griffin, for example, which you might call the third theatre, there is an economics of scale there, where theatres that have smaller sizes and therefore box office need more government subsidy. Yeah.
What about people who aren't getting a look in? I mean, it occurs to me that we're not seeing in our theatrical discussion work that's representing Indian Australians or Africans or Fijians. They're Indigenous theatre companies, and their role is self-evident. We haven't raised them this morning, but I guess we know what they're doing. But what about opening the theatre to a more diverse audience? Because it occurs to me that when I go to Belvoir or to Malthouse or to MTC or STC, it's basically the same class. It's just people disagreeing about aesthetics, but basically they're the sons and daughters of each other.
Or grandsons.
Well, I mean, I'm you know, state school educated bogan from the University of Wollongong who managed to claw my way in, and I'm more than well aware of a lack of class and social diversity that goes on in theatre programming. And obviously there's been a massive issue to do with the representation of women, which has been a conversation in Australian theatre policy for a number of years now. But like I said, this is why we have development theatres, because part of the role of a development theatre is outreach and finding the new voices, the new practitioners, targeting programs towards unrepresented communities, addressing a lack of diversity and speaking to different communities. And that takes a lot of resources. And this is where funding gets really tricky, because we're constantly having to make the argument for investment to allow us to go out, find, develop, speak to, encourage, educate, stimulate the next practice of artists. We've been able to do that really effectively with targeted funding towards Aboriginal theatre makers, and you can see the results of that, like fantastic theatre makers like Nakia Louie, who is completely brilliant, who's in development at Malthouse at the moment. But certainly, you know, that's why we have development theatres, is to have that conversation.
Well, I'd love to hear what you've got to say about this. What do you want to see from the other theatre and yet the other theatres, yet another theatre, on Facebook or Twitter, on our website? Do let us say what you've seen, what you've enjoyed in those theatre companies, what you think is missing. Van and Sam, thank you for coming in. Van and Sam, that's good. That's an act.
It is a bit of an act, let's be fair.
Van Vadim is a theatre maker. She's also the Guardian Australian's theatre critic. And Sam Strong is Associate Artistic Director of the Melbourne Theatre Company. Across Australia, this is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart.